From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, where is the sense of self located in the brain? We talk with neurologist Todd Feinberg. He's investigating this question by studying patients with brain injuries and disorders that have disrupted their identities. He's the author of the new book Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Self. Also, has the HBO prison series Oz gotten more violent, sadistic, and filled with bizarre plot twists than the creators ever expected? Co-creator Tom Fontana joins us for a return visit. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Two more of President Bush's nominees have been approved by the U.S. Senate. Gail Norton is the new Secretary of the Interior, and Christy Todd Whitman is now head of the Environmental Protection Agency. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Gail Norton was one of the new president's controversial nominees. Environmentalists opposed the former Colorado Attorney General, citing her past work with Reagan-era Interior Secretary James Watt. Norton was also opposed by some Democrats, but still won confirmation on a 75-24 vote. Christy Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey and a moderate Republican, got a much easier ride, winning confirmation 99-0. These votes mean that there's just one remaining Bush cabinet nominee yet to be confirmed, former Missouri Senator John Ashcroft for Attorney General. Democrats are concerned about Ashcroft's very conservative views on issues ranging from abortion to civil rights law. President Bush, meanwhile, says he's confident Ashcroft will be confirmed and called for a speedy vote on his nomination. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The Senate Judiciary Committee has now cleared the nomination of John Ashcroft to be Attorney General. The committee vote was 10-8 with only one Democrat supporting Ashcroft. The nomination faces strong debate, but the full Senate could vote on the choice as early as Thursday. California lawmakers are still working on a legislative package that would make the state a buyer of electricity and a bond plan to pay off a multi-billion dollar debt owed by the utilities. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Time is running short for a legislative deal in Sacramento. A $400 million stopgap fund to buy electricity has been depleted, and Pacific Gas and Electric says it will default on $437 million in short-term debt. Meanwhile, an audit of Southern California Edison shows that its holding company, Edison International, took about $5 billion out of Southern California Edison in the past 5 years. Senate Leader John Burton, a Democrat, says the audit makes it more difficult to get help from the taxpayers to pay off the utility's past debts.
Clearly, it's going to make it more difficult for the utilities to come up and say we need help paying off our past debts, because if they would have kept the money they had, they wouldn't be in debt.
Lawmakers are still waiting for an audit report of Pacific Gas and Electric. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, Sacramento.
The Food and Drug Administration says about 1,200 cattle in Texas were given feed containing ingredients that have been banned in the effort to stop mad cow disease from breaking out in the United States. Federal investigators say the cattle feed contained beef byproducts, which are banned because of the concern that they might pass on the fatal brain-wasting disease. Purina Mills Incorporated told the FDA it may have mixed meat and bone meal into a feed supplement. Federal investigators say the cows involved ate only a small amount of the supplement. This is NPR News from Washington. At least one armed man has hijacked a plane flying out of a city in the south of Colombia, where the government and leftist rebels are holding peace talks. Steve Dudley reports from Bogota.
A gunman, apparently working with two passengers, took over a Satena commercial airplane with 24 other passengers and five crew members just before takeoff from the city of San Vicente del Caguán. The airplane subsequently landed in Bogotá, where Colombian military personnel, along with the Red Cross, are negotiating with the suspected hijackers. San Vicente is home to a fragile negotiation process between the government and the country's largest rebel group, the FARC, to resolve the country's 40-year-old civil war. It's not clear who the gunmen are or what their demands are. One theory is that they're guerrillas trying to desert the rebel army. According to guerrilla code, desertion is punishable by death. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Dudley in Bogota.
Congressional auditors have reportedly raised their projection of the federal budget surplus over the next 10 years. Congressional staffers say the Congressional Budget Office projects the government will take in $3.1 trillion more than it spends. That's nearly $1 trillion more than the agency forecast last July. The latest prediction could lend support to President Bush's call for a $1.6 trillion tax cut over the next decade. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says the projection leaves plenty of room for cutting taxes. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 179 points, or 1.6%. It closed at 10,881. Advances led declines in active trading. The NASDAQ remained unchanged at 2,838. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Scientists have made many breakthroughs in understanding which parts of the brain control certain behaviors. But one of the great remaining mysteries is how the brain creates a sense of self and identity. Dr. Todd Feinberg is a neurologist who's investigating this by studying patients with brain injuries or disorders that have disrupted this sense of self. For instance, a person who no longer recognizes that his arm is part of his own body, or a person who thinks his own spouse is a stranger. Dr. Feinberg describes his work in his new book, Altered Egos: How the Brain Creates the Self. He teaches at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and is the chief of the Betty and Morton Yarman Division of Neurobehavior and Alzheimer's Disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. I asked him what he means when he says he's looking for where the sense of self is located in the brain.
Where is your subjective sense of who you are, what you are, and how you feel about yourself? So I'm trying to find the neurological underpinnings of the inner I, the self, the subjective self, the ego, the part of yourself that you feel is the most intimate aspect of your inner self.
In order to research what part of the brain might control the sense of self, you're studying people with brain injuries and brain disorders. How can studying the brain injuries and disorders help you figure this out?
By studying patients who have brain damage, we find that many areas of the brain make a contribution to the self. So I set out, this is now 15 years ago, through behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry to determine what areas of the brain contributed to the self. And we do that by doing an analysis of a particular area of the brain is damaged. This leads to a certain disorder of the self. Another area of the brain is damaged. This leads to a different disorder of the self. Trying to put all these areas together in the brain can help us understand how diverse areas contribute to the unified self that we experience as our inner I.
And your book is filled with really fascinating case studies of people with brain disorders that really do affect their sense of self. For example, tell us the story of the woman who didn't recognize that her arm was her own arm.
This disorder is called asomatognosia, and it is actually very common. It occurs when a patient has damage to the right hemisphere of the brain, the non-dominant hemisphere. Our language is in our left hemisphere, and vast majority of right-handers and even the majority of left-handers have language in the left hemisphere. And a stroke on the left side can give you what we call aphasia, which is a disorder of language, the inability to communicate or understand what is said to you. On the other hand, a patient with a right hemisphere lesion has a different syndrome that we call hemispatial neglect. And this is where the patient ignores or fails to pay attention to the left side of space and the left side of their body sometimes. Asomatognosia is when the patient with a right hemisphere lesion disavows or denies ownership of the limb. So what we do is in a right hemisphere stroke patient, we'll take the arm, lift it up, show it to them, and ask the patient, well, what is this? And patients who have asomatognosia, as many of the cases in my book do, will misidentify that arm. They may call it a deodorant, a rusty chicken wing. They may refer to it as the doctor's arm. Some people may give it a name, like Gammy or Toby or my little monkey, and they will treat it often as an entity separate from themselves. Some patients even try to feed the arm, where they'll pick it up and pat it and sing songs to it, or treat it as if it were a child. Women typically misidentify their left arm when they have this condition as belonging to a husband. Men, interestingly enough, I have found, often will misidentify it as their mother-in-law's arm.
I want to ask what your interpretation of that is.
This is a true fact, though. I've seen this over and over again. So it's interesting.
So do you ever try to convince the patient that the arm is actually their own? And if so, what's their reaction to that?
One of the interesting things about asomatognosia, and indeed really all of the disorders that I consider in my book, are that they're refractory to correction. Patients resist the truth in these circumstances, which is why they're somewhat different from other simple neurobehavioral syndromes such as paralysis of the right arm, for example. These patients will oftentimes deny the truth of the situation in spite of being told over and over again, for instance, that is your left arm. Look, it's connected to your shoulder. It's got your ring on it. It looks identical to the other arm, and yet these patients will still resist the truth. And one of the perplexing problems in behavioral neurology is, why are patients so resistant to the truth? It's almost as if they're denying the truth about the left arm. And this pertains not just to asomatognosia. This pertains to another disorder that we're interested in called anosognosia, which is unawareness of the paralysis. Most of these patients have paralysis of the left arm. They have a right hemisphere stroke. They can't move their left arm. And not only do they misidentify it, but they may claim that the arm is as strong as the normal arm, that there's been no change in its function, and that it can move quite normally. And those two conditions, anosognosia and asomatognosia, often go together.
Let's look at another brain disorder that creates a pathology in the sense of self. And this is one that's called delusional misidentification syndrome, where a person thinks that their family or their friends have been replaced by imposters. What's an example of that?
There's a common delusional misidentification syndrome known as Capgras syndrome. And this is one that actually I'm sure many of your listeners have either heard of or may have even had a loved one experience, because it is actually rather common, and it occurs in, for instance, Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And this is where an individual of the patients, particularly a spouse or child, is claimed to be an imposter. So, for instance, the common scenario is, and this is a patient who, by the way, is psychiatrically not had problems previously, but develops a brain disease. And you can see this in psychiatric conditions, but in neurological cases, these are patients who have no delusional thinking prior to the development of a brain disease. And they'll walk in and they'll say, "This is not my wife. This is an imposter. I don't know where my wife is, but this is not her. This is not the original. This is not the one that I know. This is not the one that I'm related to. This is not the original. The original is somewhere else, and this is a double." And that's called the Capgras syndrome, and we see this quite commonly in the neuropsychiatric clinic. It is a denial of the identity of a person, particularly someone close to you. So it's a daughter, a spouse, a brother, someone that the patient has a lot of interaction with. And when this presents, it's often in the early stages of brain disease, so that the patient in other respects is actually quite normal. They just have this one particular delusional misidentification syndrome.
Now, you're studying these disorders of the self to help you understand what part of the brain or what parts of the brain help create the sense of self. What clue does this disorder give you?
Well, one interesting aspect of the Capgras syndrome, and there's the related syndrome, the Fregoli syndrome, which is where the patient will claim that a stranger is actually somebody that they know, the opposite scenario, is that the right hemisphere plays an important role in these particular syndromes. Patients with right hemisphere damage, be it stroke or atrophy of one hemisphere or a brain injury from a car accident, oftentimes have damage to the right hemisphere, again implicating the importance of the right hemisphere, the non-dominant hemisphere, in establishing relatedness and the sense of self and who you are. So that points us in a direction of localization, that there appears to be a dominance for that hemisphere, for the right hemisphere, in self-awareness and the subjective self of who we are and how we're related to people in the world. So that's another clue that that's an important part of the brain that contributes to the self.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Todd Feinberg, and he's the head of the Division of Neurobehavior and Alzheimer's Disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. He's written a new book called Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Self. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is neurologist Dr. Todd Feinberg, and he's the head of neurobehavior and Alzheimer's disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. His new book is called Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Self. Let's talk about another disorder of the self, the alien hand syndrome. Tell us about that.
The alien hand syndrome is really one of the most interesting disorders that we come across. What happens is if a patient has damage to a structure called the corpus callosum, which is this massive fiber bundle that connects the left and right hemisphere and coordinates the actions of the two hemispheres, if that structure is damaged, cut either surgically or by tumor or by stroke, one hand may not know what the other hand is doing. And there are circumstances where, in particular, if it's only the corpus callosum that is damaged, the left hand escapes the patient's conscious, willful intentions. And that left hand may grab cups and throw them across the room, and the patient has no sense of purpose about doing any of these things. The hand actually may attack the patient. So one of my patients repeatedly woke up at night with the hand around his throat, and that's not uncommon. Self-strangling of the left hand occurs. Another patient's hand would grope along his leg, rip off his pajamas, and with the left hand, the right hand had to grab it, wrestle it to the floor, and this kind of intermanual conflict can occur, especially early on when the corpus callosum is divided. Why this is interesting is because what it tells us about unity, about brain unity, what it tells us is that, indeed, there is no consciousness or mind that does not require cerebral integration. If you destroy the corpus callosum, there are times at which the brain can act as if it possessed two minds, two independent entities. So anatomical integrity is critical to mental unity. On the other hand, there's another interesting aspect to this problem, which is that alien hand is rare. Most patients who have damage to the corpus callosum alone don't get it. And if they do get it, it resolves rather rapidly.
It's amazing how so many of these disorders that you're describing have echoes in horror movies.
Yeah. Well, the left alien hand, or the alien hand, is sometimes called the Dr. Strangelove effect, from the movie where Peter Sellers has an arm that repeatedly The character that Peter Sellers plays repeatedly tries to make a Nazi salute, and the other arm has to wrestle it down. And indeed, many of these disorders, I wouldn't say restricted to horror movies. I think that the literary and cinematic themes frequently draw from these neurobehavioral syndromes. And when you become aware of them, it's extraordinary how commonly you'll see doubles represented or Capgras syndrome represented. I mean, the invasion of the body snatchers is classic delusional misidentification syndrome and all their variants. I point out that The Wizard of Oz is probably the most well-known Fugoli syndrome ever reported, where the Tin Man, the Lion, and the Scarecrow are actually, they have other identities, the farmhands from Kansas, inserted into their beings. This is a Fugoli syndrome par excellence. So if one becomes aware of these things, you'd be amazed at how widely they ramify in cultural themes and in personal dreams.
Well, it sounds as if there are various parts of the brain that work together in creating a sense of self. It's not like you're going to find one part that handles it.
Well, that's my opinion. I mean, I just had a very lively debate with somebody at a meeting in Florida about that. But in my opinion, I have great difficulty excluding virtually any area as making a contribution to the self. There, I find more areas that make a contribution to the self than those that don't. And I would include the frontal lobes, the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere, all these areas of the brain, or at least many of these areas of the brain, make a contribution to the self. And the real puzzle then becomes, we'd like to take a finger or a probe and point and say, "Eureka, there it is. I've got it. There is the self. All I need to do is take this area and image it, and I'll image the neurological basis of this person's self." But it's not that easy. There are so many areas that contribute to the self. The real perplexing puzzle, the mystery, is how do these areas all combine? How are they all put together to create the seamless inner I that we all experience as I?
Say you actually succeeded in figuring out a model for how the brain creates a sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
Where would that leave us? What would we be able to do or understand that we can't do or understand now?
Well, to be perfectly honest, most of this work is done for the love of the work. It's done simply to get a better understanding of who we are.
What it means to be human.
What it means to be human. And I mean, I recall, I'd say probably the age of 7 or 8, and becoming aware that I had thoughts that didn't seem to be anywhere. And I started to think, well, where is my mind? I mean, I know I have this brain inside my head, but I could point to my brain, but where's my mind? How does this material object, how does this brain produce the mind? And ultimately, in my training and practice as a neurologist and a psychiatrist, which is really quite aside from the more neurophilosophical implications of the work that I do, I became fascinated by these patients who had these disorders of the self. So it's really simply an intellectual pursuit, a greater understanding of what it means to be a human being, what it means to have a mind, what it means to have a self. Now, I do believe that actually, if I'm correct as to what's going on here, I believe it does have important implications for the neuroscience and understanding how the brain is combined and organized.
You know, I'm thinking when someone takes their loved one to you, the doctor, mm-hmm. and their loved one has one of these brain disorders in which their mm-hmm. sense of self is broken in some fundamental way, the people in the family must be just horrified and upset about this really disturbing phenomenon. Whereas for you, it's in part just absolutely fascinating because it's mm-hmm. it's leading you to all these larger observations about the brain and the sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what my question is, but I guess you must be operating on a really different level than the really worried family is. And is that ever of any consolation to them? That
what we try to do is help the family understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'll explain the phenomenon, relieve them of their guilt, help them to cope with the circumstances from an emotional standpoint, which is a big part of the therapy. And at the same time, we're trying to cure with medication, counseling, the patient's problem in the first place. In most of these conditions, we have an approach to treatment, be it medication, psychotherapy, family counseling. You'd be amazed at how much we're able to improve the patient's life, the family's ability to deal with that patient, and avoid a lot of conflict within the family by explaining to them what's happening here, why this is going on, that this is not the patient's fault, this is not your fault, this is what the brain does, this is how the brain adapts. In the meantime, we're trying to cure them. And indeed, many of these conditions can be treated.
What's one of the most amazing breakthroughs in the treatment of brain disorders that have developed during the time that you've been practicing medicine?
Well, for me, probably the most important development has been the memory medications that we have. When I started back in, and I started my practice back in 86, 87, we had no medications at all. Now we have several that are available to treat memory disorders, and we've seen that kind of advance. It's not a cure, but it helps the disorder, and also our greater understanding of Alzheimer's disease and its neurobiology. We're hopeful that in the next couple of years, we're going to really have some big breakthroughs. So we're waiting for those, and I would say that our understanding of that condition has just exploded over the last 10 years. And I think our understanding of the brain in general has been seen enormous advances from when I was back in medical school, for instance.
Well, Dr. Feinberg, thank you so much for sharing some of your work with us.
Okay.
Dr. Todd Feinberg is the author of the new book, Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Sense of Self. He's chief of the Division of Neurobehavior and Alzheimer's Disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe, on the web at hollandamerica.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Deep in the Heart, a debut novel about love, motherhood, and family. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The HBO series Oz is about life inside a maximum security prison. It shows frontal nudity, rape, murder, and acts of pure sadism. Coming up, we talk with executive producer Tom Fontana about how the show has evolved and what his mother thinks about it. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Oz. That's the name on the street for the Oswald Maximum Security Penitentiary. Oz is retro. Oz is retribution. You want to punish a man? Separate him from his family. Separate him from himself. Cage him up with his own kind.
That's an excerpt from the new CD, Oz, the Soundtrack. Oz is the HBO series that follows the lives of inmates in the experimental unit of a maximum security prison. Prisons are violent places, but hopefully few are quite as violent as life in Oz, where rape, murder, and creative acts of sadism are routine aspects of daily life. The series has become famous for its violence, nudity, bizarre and surprising plot twists, and terrific acting. My guest, Tom Fontana, is the co-creator of Oz and writes many of the episodes. He also co-created the series Homicide, Life on the Street. Oz started its fourth season this month. Fontana first joined us when the series premiered in 1997. We invited him back to discuss how the series has evolved. In our first interview about Oz, when the series was first beginning, you explained that you'd done research in prisons, not so much to get stories where people told you the best and the funniest anecdotes about being in prison. What you said you wanted was to just get a sense of the texture and the feeling of the place, to try to get to if there was a common feeling about what it was like to be locked up in a prison. Do you still feel the series is about what it's really like to be locked up in prison, or do you think the series is headed off in another direction?
Well, I would say still that it represents, it approximates what it's like to be living a lifetime in prison. I think that from an individual story point, every once in a while I've gotten a little giddy in my storytelling.
Thank you for saying that, but, yes.
but I also think because if we just did the actual rhythm of a life in prison, it would get very repetitious by this point. So, as I said, I think we're still approximating what it's like, and still a lot of the stories that I'm doing are actual things that have happened in prison. I haven't invented too much stuff. It's just every once in a while I get a little Jacobean in my in the twist and the turn of the story.
So some of the stories are based on reality, but they don't all happen to the same person in the same place on the same day as they do in Oz.
Exactly. Well, the thing about, you know, the thing about episodic television in general, if you looked at NYPD Blue or Homicide or Sopranos or any television drama series, over the course of seven seasons, so many things happen to a character that it does start to seem like the Book of Job. That's why, you know, a movie, it's just clean. It's okay, here's 2 hours of whatever's going to happen to this character. So the accumulative effect of what a character like Tobias Beecher has gone through, let's say, can feel to somebody like, oh my God, you know, it's impossible. And I suppose in real life it is impossible, but as you said, the actual specific events are still very real.
Oz has, like, you know, the handsomest prisoners in the world. There's some, like, mighty attractive guys in this prison.
Well, you know what's funny about when you go to a real prison, you're stunned by how healthy. I mean, they're all buff because they work out in the gym. They don't have anything else to do. But they all look great. They look much better than I look.
But I mean, when I say attractive, I mean their faces, not their bodies, their faces. I mean, these are these are real, like, hunks in prison. Is that intentional on your part? Do you think that's part of the appeal of the show, to have a few of the guys be really attractive for the men and the women who are watching? And I should add, some of these guys end up appearing naked in the series as well.
Well, I would say that I've never cast anybody consciously because they were attractive or unattractive. I do think that the show has a mix of faces and a mix of looks about it. There are some, you know, good-looking guys in it that I cast because I thought they were the best actors. But I'm sure that's why some people watch the show. I hope it's not the only reason people watch the show.
Can you compare the feedback you get from men and women about the sex on the show and the men's bodies on the show? And I don't mean to treat lightly what goes on in Oz, which includes a lot of very violent rape, but I mean, it's just so clear in the series that there's a lot of, like, sex appeal that the series is supposed to have.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe I'm overly naive about these things because it's not something that I think about. I mean, I don't put people in the hole naked because I go, oh well, this is a moment where somebody's gonna get excited in watching television. I don't do the violence or the nudity because I can. I do it because that's the moment. I mean, you'll notice there's sometimes when people get sent into the hole where you don't see very much because throwing somebody in the hole naked has now become almost a cliche on the show. So for me, it's less interesting to do that. And if somebody says, well, they're not doing that anymore, I mean, it's not that we're not doing it at all, but we're doing it less. But if somebody says, well, I'm not watching the show anymore because there's no more naked male bodies in the hole, well, then they should go watch something else. I wish them well.
I'll tell you the scene that particularly surprised me, and this was, I think, at the end of the last season. One of the characters was urinating nude into a bucket. And
yes.
It was the most explicit urination scene I've ever seen on TV.
Well, yeah. he was actually really urinating. I mean, the actor was actually urinating. There was no tricks up our sleeves. Well, he was naked, so there were no sleeves in any case. But that again was the purpose of that was not for us to go nya. We can show a guy urinating, really urinating in a bucket. It was to say, well, we've been in this hole how many times? And if you're going to actually be still shocked by the fact that people are shoved in this hole, maybe you ought to be reminded that they don't just go in there and sit there, that they actually have to, you know, perform bodily functions in there. And you get a sense of the smell and you get a sense of the totality of what it is to be locked in that room for, let's say, a month, you know? I mean, it's to make a point. It's not to say, you know, oh, look there, aren't we adorable that we did that?
It's probably just a little bit of both, don't you think, though, that I mean, don't you make waves in what might be an interesting way by doing that and get attention for it?
Well, I hope so. I don't actually know how much attention we got in the sense of, I think people might have talked about it the next day. And you're right. I mean, I definitely want to make waves. It's not that I'm, saying I don't want to make waves. But what I'm saying is I wouldn't do it if I didn't actually think that the moment was right for it. It wasn't an arbitrary, like, whimsical, well, what haven't we done? Oh, we haven't shown a guy pissing in a bucket. It was to say, well, what's the next thing to get the audience, to keep the audience, stunned by what the lifestyle is in a prison.
Have there been any protests? Have there been any special interest groups or lobby groups who've been on your case because of the sex and nudity and violence?
No, not that I'm aware of. The only people that I've ever gotten negative letters from were like the Aryan Brotherhood.
What were they angry about?
I think sometimes they think our portrayal of the Aryan Brotherhood isn't as positive as it might be. But other than that, I've never gotten any kind of negativity off of the violence or the sex because, again, I think that people understand they're going to watch HBO. There is a different criteria. But also, if they're going to watch Oz, it's not about us being sensationalistic. It's about us doing what I think we need to do to represent the world that we're showing.
My guest is Tom Fontana, co-creator of the HBO prison series Oz. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Fontana, co-creator of the HBO prison series Oz. He also writes many of the episodes. Do you ever get letters from prisoners or former prisoners?
All the time. All the time.
What's the range of response you get?
Well, I mean, the bulk of the letters are usually, I'm innocent, can you help me get out? Or I heard that you did a story about this, and that's like my case. Is that based on anything that I could use for my defense? or I'm getting out of prison and I would love to come in and talk to you and see if I could get a job. And I treat every letter, you know, very seriously. And I've met with a number of men who've gotten out of prison to see if I could help them. You know, it's a tricky situation because you obviously want to do the best you can. I mean, a lot of our extras are former inmates. So, you know, sometimes that's a way to help people out is by giving them a job as an extra.
Has that worked out smoothly, working with former inmates on the set?
Yeah, we haven't had one problem. We haven't had one problem. It's a pretty happy set, all things considered.
Now, the prisoners in Oz watch this kids' TV show, and it's a TV show in which there's a woman host, and the puppet that she uses is often near her breast, and mm-hmm. it's quite sexual to mm-hmm. the prisoners who are watching. What gave you the idea for that show and for this prisoner's sexual interpretation of what's happening?
Well, they tend to watch the most, they watch like aerobics shows and things like that because they're really interested in seeing women and women's breasts. And I wanted to do the Miss Sally Schoolyard. It's kind of, in one part, it's like an homage to Bert Hillstrom and Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, but also because I just love the irony of the fact that these criminals were watching this children's show, and they would have these dopey little morals, like be friendlier to your neighbor, or you know, don't forget to, you know, say thank you, and just the absurdity of the fact that these guys would be watching Miss Sally's for totally the wrong reason, only to look at the woman, you know.
Right. There's a lot of new prisoners on Oz this season, and one of the new prisoners is played by Luke Perry, who played Dylan on Beverly Hills 90210. Mm-hmm. Why don't you describe his part on Oz?
Well, what he is he's a televangelist, but he's not a you know, swaggerty Falwell guy. He's not a kind of a button down Midwest guy. He's a much more of a, I mean, Luke's got very long hair and he's got a beard, so he actually looks more like Jesus than he does like Falwell. And the idea was is that I didn't want to bring this guy in as a phony. I wanted him to be whatever crime he committed, which it was embezzling from his own church. I didn't want him to be just this like blowhard, you know, fundamentalist. I wanted him to have real Christian values and to see how those Christian values helped or hindered people in the prison. And also to put that character through and what he goes through in the episodes he's in is a number of the seven deadly sins he is subjected to or attempted by, I should say. And I thought it would be interesting to take a guy who does truly believe in his Christian values and put him, you know, Mark Twain said temptation virtue isn't virtue till it's tempted. And it's easy to be in a life and say, well, this is what I do and this is what I believe and that, and then to put him in an intense environment like Oz and put his virtue to the test and see where he comes out at the end of it.
Well, let's hear a scene that's an example of that. And in this scene, Luke Perry is working out, lifting weights, and a young, you know, very attractive prisoner who's new comes up to him and offers to give him sex.
Healthy body, healthy mind. In the Catholic Church, the body is a temple of the Holy Spirit that we're supposed to keep pure. Do you believe that, preacher?
The body is God's gift to us. We're obligated to take care of it.
What about sex? Is that a gift to God, too?
Of course.
How'd you like a...
What makes you think I want a...
Everybody wants a...
No, thank you. Step back, please. You made a lifetime out of being adorable, sexy in a lost little boy kind of way. But you threw your baby in the trash. That's a man's crime. It's time for you to be a man.
You want to talk a little bit about writing that scene?
Well, you know, as I was just saying, starting with the two characters in the scene, both of whom were established before the scene, Luke's character is a guy who the rest of the prisoners are now going to be kind of sniffing around him to see what they can get from him and what they can do to entice him. And the other character, Timmy Kirk, who has been this kind of little boy sneaking his way through and getting things that he's wanted by flirting and things like that. The fun of writing Oz is to create different characters and then put all these different characters, you know, two by two or three by three in a scene together and see what kind of explosion happens. And so that was where that scene came from. I thought, well, let's see what this guy's got. Let's see what Luke Perry's character's got. This is his first temptation. Let's see what he's really made of.
What came first for you, wanting to give Luke Perry a part in Oz, or writing this character of the televangelist, and then looking for somebody to play it and deciding on Luke Perry?
No, they actually happen simultaneously, as it does with a lot of the actors on Oz. If I know their work, I try to create a part for them. I've known Luke a number of years and always wanted to work with him, and I didn't want to write something that he'd already done, and I thought it would be kind of great to bring him in as this famous televangelist because, you know, Luke is famous, and I thought it justified the fact that most of the actors on Oz are unknowns, but Luke Perry is an unknown, and this televangelist was an unknown. And to Luke's credit, he was extraordinary. He jumped in both feet. A lot of times the actors are just background. They have no dialogue, and I said to him, "You're going to be sitting around for a lot, you know, in the background. The camera may see you, it may not see you." And he said, "Tom, I am here. I'll do it." And he had such a great spirit, and everybody, all the other actors, just loved having him around. So,
now, I didn't see this episode, but I understand that Uta Hagen, the great stage actress and the revered acting teacher, had a part on Oz. How did you end up casting her?
Well, I've known Rita. I've known Uta a long time, and she and I'd worked together before. And I just called her up and said, I've got this part. And she read the script, said, I'm on my way over. And she actually, when she was done, because it was just the one scene, she had a scene with George Moore Fogan playing his mother. And we shot it, and she got up, and she said, "You know, I've done a lot of movies, done a lot of things." She said, "That's the fastest I've ever worked, and I had the best time," because it was just, it was all about spontaneity, and it wasn't about the technology of making a film. So she had a blast, and I actually, I adore working with her. She's just, I mean, the set was like, I could have sold tickets to the set that day because there were so many actors sitting around watching her work, you know.
Was there anything you felt you had to protect her from?
No. Uta Hagen? No. She's tougher than anybody.
Okay.
I mean, you don't survive that many years in the theater without having the skin of a rhino. You don't have to worry about Uta. She can take care of herself.
Now, here's one of the really improbable plot twists on Oz that I have to ask you about. Mm-hmm. A couple of episodes ago, there was a group of Chinese immigrants that had absolutely no place to stay, and it was arranged through the government, I think it was through the government, that they would stay on cots in Oz. And they're even allowed to mingle with the prisoners. And I guess no big surprise, one of them is brutally murdered. I mean, did it ever really happen that that immigrants were
well,
put up in a prison and allowed to mingle with the most hardened prisoners?
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I did. I think they were put in prison facilities. They were separated more than I did on the show. But they were basically, you know, shoved anywhere they could be shoved while the situation was resolved. No, I don't disagree that it was that I took a little license there and put them in Oz. I mean, put them in Emerald City. You know, for me, it was more about a story about, you know, another kind of prisoner, another kind of disenfranchised person in the world, you know, and how does that measure up to what goes on in a prison? So I may have been gone too far out on the limb with that one, but I'm glad I did the story, and I thought that actor was terrific.
My guest is Tom Fontana, co-creator of the HBO prison series Oz. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Fontana, co-creator of the HBO prison series Oz. He also writes many of the episodes. Strange question. I'm not sure if your parents are even alive, so forgive me
for
asking this. Does your mother ever watch Oz?
Yes.
What does she have to say about it?
Well, it's interesting. When the show first was coming on the air, she said, "Oh, Tommy, I hear you have another show coming on the air." And I said, "Yeah, but Mom, I don't think you should watch this one." And she said, "Why not?" And I tried it in very, gentle ways explain what the show was about and why I didn't think she'd watch it. And she said, "Oh, I think I should watch that." And we got into a kind of an argument on the phone, almost as if she was my daughter. And I was like, "No, under no circumstances can you watch that. And I'm going to get a V-chip and I'm going to put it in your TV set and blah, blah, blah." And she said, "You know, you can't tell me what to watch and I can watch whatever I want." And it was playful, but I was really concerned. And I finally said to her, "Okay, you can watch the show under two conditions. One is that we can never speak of it again. And two, that if any of your friends say, 'I saw your son's show,' say, 'Oh, no, that's the other Tom Fontana who writes that show.'" So the first episode premiered, and we talk every Sunday, that Sunday, she didn't say anything, and I thought, "Oh, phew." And then the second week, same thing, she didn't say anything. Third week, she said to me, "I got to ask you a question." And I go, "What?" She says, "It's about Oz." I go, "Mom, we agreed we'd never talk about it." And she said, "No, I just have one question." And I go, "All right, what's the question?" And she said, "Is anybody going to die next week?" She said, "Because they're all such nice boys. I don't want to see any of them die." And she and her girlfriends, they watch the show and then they call each other the next day and they talk about it. And it's one of those things that you say to yourself, "Oh my God, my 80-year-old mother watches Oz
and thinks that they're all such nice guys,
nice boys. Yeah, she gets very, you know, because she understands them like a good mother, you know.
I think it's because they're your creations. Now, I understand that at the beginning of Oz, we see somebody getting an Oz tattoo, and we see the tattoo being inscribed, and him being a little bloodied by the inscription.
Yes.
I understand you have an Oz tattoo.
That is me in the opening sequence of the show. That is my shoulder. I didn't let him shoot my face because I was screaming. No. I actually have several tattoos, and when we were doing the opening, actually Sheila Nevins from HBO suggested that I do the tattoo, and I thought it was such a good idea, and I set the whole thing up, and we got a a real prison, a tattoo artist to come. A guy who was out of prison who came to do it. And so we were all, and everybody kept saying, who's going to get the tattoo? And I was going, oh, somebody will get it, somebody will get it. And we got to the moment of truth, and nobody wanted to get it. And I said, well, I'll get it. And we sat there, and we were shooting it, and the director of the sequence kept going, all right, let's do one more take. And, oh, okay, let's do one more take. All right, we'll do one more take. And, you know, and I'm sitting there in the thing, and the whole crew's waiting for me to, like cry or scream or something, but I didn't, because, as I said, I have other tattoos, so I knew the sensation. And the tattoo artist finally said, when the director said, let's do another take, he said, you know, if I cut into this guy anymore, he's going to bleed to death. So that's when we stopped shooting that sequence. But that is my actual arm. And it was funny, because a lot of people said to me, well, what are you going to do? This is the first season, and we didn't know how the show would be received. They said, what are you going to do if the show gets canceled? And I said, well, I'll either meet a girl named Roz and put an R in front of it, or change the put a little dot after it and make it ounces. I'll figure out something. But fortunately, I haven't had to. And now I've had all of my shows tattooed on my body, so I'm a walking resume.
Have people said to you, what are you going to feel like when you're 80 and you have this Oz tattoo on your arm?
Man, if I live to be 80, I won't even have to answer then, you know.
So do you like the way your tattoo came out in the shot that we see every week at the opening?
Yes, yes. I'm very proud of my tattoos.
And your very mother, proud. What does she think of the tattoo?
Well, I don't think she's thrilled by any of the tattoos,
You don't really have the other tattoos on your body, do you? The other names of your shows?
No, not right. The other. Oh, I have other tattoos, but they're not the other names of the show. No, I was being physical.
Oh, yeah. Well, what are the other tattoos?
We'll say that for next time.
This apparently is none of our business, okay? We will use our vivid imaginations.
Yes, exactly, exactly. That's the whole point of Oz, right? So, get people to use their imaginations.
You are now working on next season's episodes?
We're writing the ones that we're gonna shoot in April. That would be the next season, yeah.
Any clues about what's happening?
Everyone loves each other. There's no more sex. There's no more violence. It's a perfect universe.
Nothing but reconciliation.
Right. Well, it's the Bush years now. I have to go into another mode.
Well, Tom Fontana, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for asking me back.
Tom Fontana is the co-creator of the HBO prison series Oz. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why the era of high-rise housing projects is coming to an end. We talk with sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh, author of American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto. He's been studying housing project residents and street gangs in Chicago for over a decade. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.